You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting for WFHB, this is Cade Young.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Monday, August 17th, 2020.
Four months, $500, and that can be back payment of rent, or that could be rent moving forward, or it could be a combination of both.
Later in the program, Diane Walker, contributor for the Limestone Post, talks to Jacob Seip, executive director of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, about the end of the statewide eviction moratorium. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, A Few Minutes with the Mayor, where I talk to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about local issues. But first, your local headlines. During the August 14th COVID-19 press conference, Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudell said the positivity rate for Monroe County is steady at 4.3%. She said the 7-day average rate is at a 3.2%, which has come down from the previous 4%.
Any kind of prevention that we do and public health numbers and prevention, it can be very difficult to show direct cause and effect for things, but we can show more associations. And, you know, we've had our mask order in place now for about a month. We've had our order for seating at bars and our reduced gathering sizes and those kinds of things. So as we put multiple things into play at one time, it gets more difficult to discern which exactly had the most benefit. But at any rate, I believe that 3.2% and that rolling average coming down hopefully has something to do with that mask order and the changes that we put into place.
Caudell said two deaths were recently added to the county numbers. She said all Monroe County deaths have been people over the age of 50. She said the majority of tests are being done in people 20 to 39 years old. Caudell said any order exemption applications will not be automatically granted.
We'll assess the event, the circumstances around the event, how people are taking precautions and how they can protect the individuals who are there. And we'll also look at the numbers and the current situations in the community at a time. So all of those things will go in and factor in to whether or not an exemption is allowed.
Caudell said anyone who has a COVID-19 test taken should quarantine until the test results are received. She said it is also important to respond to contact tracer messages.
I have a number for you, and I want you to kind of pay attention to the number. It's 1-833-670-0067. And I know if people are like me, if I get a call from a number I don't recognize, I'm not answering my phone. You're going to have to leave me a message and I'll call you back. So there's lots of spam out there, and people often don't answer their phone if they don't recognize a number. But that 833-670-0067 is a number that would be from our contact tracers at the state. So if you see that number come through, please answer it or respond, or make sure that you check the voicemail and then call them back so that they can talk to you about whether or not you've been named as a contact or whether or not it's in follow-up to your positive test results.
President of Indiana University Health, Brian Shockney, said Monroe County was held up as the best practice county in Indiana for COVID care. He said Monroe County has lost 32 people due to the pandemic. Shockney said IU Health is participating in the Learn Fund for Children Education.
Taking care of our community is really important to IU Health, and that's why we're excited about the Learn Fund that we are partnering on with the Community Foundation of Bloomington and Monroe County. We're happy that the IU Health Foundation and the IU Health South Central Region were able to contribute to this important project through the Community Investment Fund. Together with United Way of Monroe County and the County Community Foundation, the Learn Fund was able to launch last week with $150,000. This new initiative is focused on helping children in Monroe County get the virtual learning resources that they need and help their families get the childcare that they need. By helping low-income families and those going through extraordinary circumstances in these ways, we are ensuring these children have access to education during this next normal. Increased access to quality childcare also means that more parents and more guardians are able to get back into the workforce.
Indiana University Assistant Vice President of Strategic Partnerships, Kirk White, said Indiana University test results will be posted on a weekly basis. Caudell said positive tests from IU would be counted towards Monroe County data.
The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus held a press conference on Thursday to reveal its justice reform agenda for the 2020 legislative session. State Representative Robin Shackelford laid out five categories for the IBLC's agenda. Those categories included saving lives, holding those in power accountable, changing culture, empowering the community, and improving transparency.
We present an agenda with an approach that requires several moving pieces. The agenda has been broken down into five categories, including saving lives, which I will introduce in a bit, holding accountable, changing culture, empowering our community, and improving transparency. All of these categories are ways that we will ensure we answer the call of action by the recent murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and many more, but will also directly affect our communities by enacting systematic change that will prevent, mend, and hinder greatly any future abuse that may be inflicted upon our community in the future.
Shackelford talked about the category of saving lives. It included banning no-knock warrants, passing an inclusive hate crimes law, removing police officers from schools, and decriminalizing marijuana.
We have a lot of work to do, and we must begin by decriminalizing Jim Crow era laws, creating an inclusive hate crimes law, passing legislation that creates direct consequences in the report of false calls and claims, and establishing a study of the criminal justice system in order to fully understand the impact it has had on our community, past, present, and future. Next, we no longer want officers in our schools. All children need care versus conviction. They need more guidance counselors and social workers to help them through difficult times and provide the support necessary for their success. In order to reach our goals of reducing jail overcrowding and decriminalizing mental illness, we need to begin creating the space for our community to actively heal and get the necessary resources to do so. We also need to decriminalize marijuana and take a cold, hard look at how we have failed our youth by allowing the system to abuse them in more ways than one. We would like a study of the juvenile criminal justice system. We would also like racism to be studied as a public health crisis because our society is in direct need of transformation. Reform to us is more than the ban on no-knock warrants. It is more than body and dash cameras, more than the ban on chokeholds and neck restraints, which we want all of these as well. It is an active look at the hyper-militarization of SWAT teams and the local police departments who use their power against young protesters who have the right to express their concerns.
Senator Greg Taylor discussed holding law enforcement accountable. The caucus calls for a public database for citizen complaints against law enforcement officers.
law enforcement should have annual evaluations. We should evaluate their conduct. We should train them on a yearly basis. And a criminal investigation, a law enforcement officer has to be a healthcare worker. They have to be an EMT. They have to be a counselor. We expect all of those individuals to have continuing education. We believe, just like those other professionals, that individual liability insurance that these other professionals have should be had by law enforcement professionals. Criminal justice should be administered not just to alleviate crime, but for the restoration of our society.
Governor Eric Holcomb's office sent an email on Thursday saying the agenda is being reviewed.
Three people died after a car went down a boat ramp at Lake Monroe on Saturday night. In a statement from the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, a man, woman, and male child were in the vehicle. A WTHR report stated, quote, according to DNR, witnesses say they saw a vehicle drive down the Paynetown State Recreation Area boat ramp and go into the water around 10:30 p.m., end quote. According to witness reports, the man called out for help, but witnesses were unable to help before the car sank. The Monroe County dive team was able to retrieve the passengers, where the man and woman were pronounced dead at the scene. The boy was pronounced dead on arrival at the IU Health Bloomington Hospital.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Diane Walker, contributor for the Limestone Post, begins an ongoing series for WFHB about the end of the moratorium on evictions in Indiana. Today, she speaks with Jacob Seip, executive director of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. This is part one of her series.
I'm Diane Walker, and I'm the managing attorney for Local Legal Aid, District 10 Pro Bono Project. This interview is a follow-up for an article I wrote in Limestone Post magazine called Some Renter Help Available as End of Eviction Moratorium Looms, published at limestonemagazine.com on August 6th. I'm here today with Jacob Seip, who is the executive director of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, or IHCDA. Welcome, Jacob. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the mission of IHCDA.
Yeah, our mission at IHCDA is to promote affordable housing and support our strong communities. And we do that in a variety of different ways. We have the financing tools to create or preserve rental affordable housing across our state. We also have tools for home buyers, whether it be a first-time home buyer or a second-time home buyer. We can provide down payment assistance and mortgage credit certificates to make buying a home affordable. And then we also have some community service programs that oftentimes you may identify with a community action agency, like our energy assistance program, weatherization program. We also are the lead applicant for the state of Indiana on what's called the continuum of care, which covers 91 counties, the exception being Marion County. In Indiana, we have two continuum of cares, and IHCDA is the lead applicant. There's a board of continuum of care organizations, and they apply for primarily homeless funding through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and so there's that. So, in a nutshell, IHCDA really covers the entire housing spectrum, from homelessness to homeownership. We have some role in some different levels. That is all that work's being done, mostly through a network of partnerships of not-for-profit agencies. I should also mention that IHCDA is a quasi-agency. We have a board of directors, and that board's chair is our Lieutenant Governor, Suzanne Crouch. And IHCDA is self-sufficient. We don't receive any funding from the state of Indiana for our operations. So we are a completely self-sufficient agency. And that's the reason why we're quasi. And so a lot of that can be done with a lot of our programs that we have, like our homeownership program and the other programs that allow us to operate financially self-sufficient from the state. So.
And you are operating the rental assistance program through the COVID-19 program, or COVID-19 funds for the 91 counties outside of Marion County. Is that correct?
Yes. The state of Indiana, Governor Holcomb, provided $40 million, what's called the Coronavirus Relief Fund. These dollars came to the state of Indiana through under the CARES Act, and Marion County received its own allocation. So there were two government entities in Indiana that received Coronavirus Relief Fund, CRF, the state and then Marion County. And with that, those dollars, $40 million have been designated for a statewide rental assistance program that we're administering in the 91 counties across our state.
And that rental assistance, first of all, I should name the portal because it's important for anybody who might be listening. It's at IndianaHousingNow.org. And people can apply for rental assistance there for $500 a month up to $2,000. Is that correct?
That's correct. 4 months, $500. And that can be back payment of rent, or that could be rent moving forward, or it could be a combination of both. And we allow the renter and the landlord to work together to identify where that $500 payment should be applied.
And there is also money that is applied to people who are on the verge of homelessness, who might be evicted, or people who are homeless now. Is that correct?
That's right. We also received under the CARES Act what's called additional emergency solutions grant. Now, we normally get emergency solutions grant every year. It's an program that runs through the network, the 16 continuum of care agencies across our state. Under the CARES Act, we receive additional money. Usually, we've used those dollars for homeless prevention. However, under the CARES Act, we had the opportunity to provide some rental assistance. And so, for low-income households, renters, who also are at risk of being evicted, we can provide some additional, and it's more enhanced. It can go up to 6 months of rental assistance. What is unique about the portal at IndianaHousingNow.org is that the applicant just applies, and then at IHCDA, behind the scenes, we're trying to identify what would be the right program for the renter, that household, based on income, based on their housing burden. And so there's a couple of different variables there that we're using. As you could imagine, a lot of renters, when you see a rental assistance program like this, they're being asked to identify what program's best for them. They're asked to self-identify. And that can oftentimes be a barrier for our households who obviously are under a lot of stress, have experiencing trauma in this situation. And putting that burden on them to try to identify what's the right program to apply for and then submit multiple different applications is really unfair for a lot of our low-income renters. And so what we try to do is create a portal that allowed the renter's household to apply, asking some very high-level basic questions. And then we would, if we identified that they could potentially qualify for ESG, then we would follow up with some additional questions that we would need for them, because those are federal dollars and there's a lot more criteria and eligibility that they need to meet in order to qualify for ESG. But it is an enhanced rental assistance than we can offer under the statewide rental assistance fund that we're offering right now.
And last Wednesday, I helped somebody fill out an application online for rental aid, and they have to be impacted by the COVID-19 crisis. They have to show either a lesser income than they had in March, or they have to show that they have medical expenses. But the portal really is really easy. It's just a matter of a few questions. And I think you said that it was designed that way whenever we talked earlier.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because we spent a lot of time being sensitive to making sure that the language we were asking, how we were asking the questions, and that we were not unintentionally creating barriers for these renters. And so we were very intentional about that. I know The one thing I'm just really proud of my team, and I hope that, and I wish folks could see this, is this system, this portal didn't exist. We've never in our state had a rental assistance program like this. Mm-hmm. It didn't exist. And we created it from scratch, really within about 30 to 45 days. And so, but when we were doing it, we were very thoughtful. We also listened to a lot of our partners and some partners that we hadn't worked with before in the past, trying to understand the needs of the renters, understand what potential barriers could be there, some questions that we might ask that be intimidating to some folks.
Right.
So we were very intentional to try to do that. I'm glad to hear you say it. I don't think we were perfect. I'm not saying that at all, right. But I do think listening to our housing partners, we did really try, and we are trying to make sure that we're not putting any unnecessary burden onto renters to fill out an application. Because as you know, anytime you apply for housing choice vouchers or any program, federal program, boy, there's just a web of questions, and it's all well-intended. It's all good to be diligent and to be responsible for the public dollars, which is what we're doing. There's definitely all those things are in place, but you have to be careful about how you ask questions.
Right. And, you know, there's a fair amount, you know, I work with low-income people or people who've had some sort of tragedy or stress in their life. And certainly this would count as one of those things. And even though you know it's not your fault, there's a fair amount of shame in having to ask for help at any time.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of renter applications come, and the first thing they tell us is we've never applied for any type of government assistance before.
Right.
And I hope that they're confident and comfortable in going through this process.
Now it's time for a few minutes with the mayor. In today's installment, I talked to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about the state's lack of no-excuse mail-in voting, COVID-19 data collection in the county, and wastewater testing for COVID-19 hotspots. Here is that interview. Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions. So our first question today is, how do you feel about Indiana not having an option for no-excuse mail-in voting?
I think it is irresponsible for Indiana not to have an option for no-excuse mail-in voting. We did it in the spring in the primary. It worked very well. We're one of only 8 states in the country that's not allowing this in the middle of a pandemic and a major election. It's really disgraceful, I believe, that we do not make it easier for people to vote by mail. The governor and the state election board can and should move forward on this. I've reached out to the governor directly. I know numbers of people are encouraging them to call 317-232-4567 to let them know how important this is. I will also say that you are allowed to certify that you need an absentee ballot because you will be confined to your residence due to illness. Some people believe, and I think it's not irrational to believe, that if you are confined away from the polling place due to concerns about COVID, that you can request an absentee ballot that way. It does mean an individual has to choose to request it for that purpose. In my view, that's a reasonable position to take.
Unless this changes, do you think that this will affect the turnout of Indiana voters come November?
Yes, I think it will affect the turnout, and that's one of the reasons that it's being implemented. It's been a strategy across the country, and I'm afraid it's something of a strategy in our own state to suppress the vote by various means, whether it's the very, very strict ID requirements that Indiana led the nation in putting in place, and unfortunately the Supreme Court approved, or whether it's things like making it hard to get an absentee ballot. This is America, and we want people to vote. We should encourage as much voting as we can so that as many people participate and make it easy. Indiana has the shortest voting day of any state in the country. Nobody has a shorter one, and we make it difficult for people to vote. And I think that's a theme and a very unfortunate belief that if one party seems to believe that if too many many people show up, it won't be good for them. That's not a good sign for a political party.
So the next question I have is, will the results of Indiana University's COVID-19 testing be publicly available to the Bloomington community?
Indiana University's test of their students and others, yes, will be made public. It actually publicly reported even now to the state health department, so it gets included in all the aggregate numbers. But I understand from Indiana University that probably next week, as soon as classes begin and they have completed the pre-arrival and arrival testing, they will start to release weekly their data on what they show. And that'll be important. They're testing thousands of people, and they're sharing some of that basic information now with the public health officials, which is important and helpful. But in terms of public release, it should come in the next week or two, I expect.
And how do you anticipate IU's cancellation of their fall sports will impact the local economy?
The Big Ten's cancellation of fall sports is a big deal for Bloomington and cities like us with Big Ten universities. I've read the tourism experts say that canceling just the football home season has about a $30 million impact in Bloomington's economy. And if you do some of the multipliers, that equates to about 500 jobs locally. That's 1% of our city workforce working in Bloomington. That's a significant hit. And many tourism-related institutions, from hotels to restaurants to service providers, are going to be affected by this. We're taking it seriously in the city and working with our community to try to think about ways we can be a supporter and maybe reaching out to the community as a whole. It's, you know, Bloomington is a tourism economy. We have millions of visitors a year. And when we have a change like this, on top of the COVID impacts overall, it's definitely a challenge.
And you kind of touched on this, but just to see if there's anything else you wouldn't say, does the city have any plans to help businesses who will struggle to make up their lost income?
You know, we've been working since April with a task force, Economic Stabilization and Recovery Task Force, that is led by city government, but includes business sector and labor and other folks from the economy, tourism, to do loan programs to help businesses, to do technical assistance and linking people to existing other state and federal programs. And we will continue that. I do think the cancellation of the fall sports season is going to spur that group to activate more conversation with downtown Bloomington and other enterprises to think about what can we do to help these organizations, whether it's more loan programs or grant programs, whether it's new assistance programs. I do think in the end, the scale of these challenges does need a national and state collaborative solution. It's the national government that can do the major stimulus programs. Those are so important. We want to see them stepping in to do another round of stimulus and recovery financing. The House of Representatives has moved forward. We're waiting on the Senate and the President, who seem to be dragging their feet. Those are really important to help our local community, and I strongly urge that they move forward.
Bloomington Utilities is beginning a project this week to test wastewater for COVID-19 hotspots. Could you speak a little bit about this project or how it works?
This is an interesting experiment, and I'm really pleased. Utilities has been looking at this for several months, actually, a number of weeks now, and I've been talking to them over that period. It appears, the scientists tell us, that COVID viruses are detectable in the wastewater. I won't go into the great details of that, but the things that we eliminate from our body can contain the viruses, and we are able to detect those, it appears, in wastewater. So we've actually got several weeks of data from our wastewater plants. That's that we got two plants that get all the wastewater from the city and the area. And we've taken samples over the last several weeks, and those are being analyzed right now. You have to freeze them and send them to a lab so that the viruses don't degrade. And then this week, we're going to begin putting in what are some auto samplers. These are machines that you put into the wastewater stream that sample over a 24-hour period to get a representative sample. Then you freeze the results, you send them to a lab, and you try to identify how much bacteria, how much virus, COVID-19 virus is present. We're going to place those strategically at some locations around the city, do 3 times a week sampling, and see if we can watch for changes in the baselines. If we see, for example, at an area of a lot of student housing that has a manhole, a sewer cover we can use to look at and put a machine in there, we'll check to see if it changes. It's an experiment. It's being led by scientists. The state finance authority is helping finance it, so we appreciate that. And we hope it's just one more data point to help us watch what's going on with the infection rates in our community.
So the last question I have today is, what is the reason for the county health department reporting COVID cases as a positivity rate and not just an actual number of cases?
Well, we get reports on a number of factors, including how many cases and including how many tests and how many deaths and how many hospitalizations, and those are all relevant. The positivity rate is an important one, and the health experts tell us that, and the World Health Organization uses that as a benchmark. The positivity rate is how many people who are tested have a positive test, and the World Health Organization, for example, likes to see 14 days of a positivity rate below 5% before you loosen any further restrictions. Monroe County right now, our latest 7-day rolling average is around 3%, a little over 3%. So that's a good thing. State average is around 8%. So we're significantly better than that, and the national average similar. So that positivity rate is what the experts say is more important than just the number of tests or the number of positive tests. It's how many people who are tested have a positive test rate. And if you're testing a fair amount of people, which we are not yet, we still need to test a lot more, that really can help you identify the direction your community is going. So we do watch that positivity rate closely, along with other factors like hospitalizations and deaths and new cases. Those numbers are all relevant.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by myself and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Diane Walker, with help from our very own Melanie Davis. A Few Minutes with the Mayor was produced by Sydney Foreman.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
And I'm Cade Young. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as other WFHB news programming, online at WFHB.org.
You too can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for With Good Reason, coming up next on WFHB.